Good morning. Good to see everybody. I'm Ruth. I'm one of the pastors here. And as Matthew mentioned, we are wrapping up our Advent series, The Culture of Christmas, which is looking at, as Jesse said, actually mix you two up all the time, you know, very similar. But it's looking at Christmas books, movies, even commercials, poems. And today we are going to be looking at Christmas with the Poets, which, to be honest, probably doesn't have the instant appeal of, say, The Grinch or Santa Claus or It's a Wonderful Life. You might be thinking poetry, well, that's a little bit serious, a little less fun. But is it? Here is a poem I found. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. But if I should run out of the wine, I will gladly drink the red, though. And before you say, yeah, that's not very funny, I know it took me, this is true, 13 websites of Googling funny Christmas poems, even to find that. So yes, poetry can be a little serious. And I think that's because it doesn't just seek to entertain. It asks us to slow down, way down. And that's really hard to do, particularly at this time of the year when we're go, go, go. It asks us to slow down in order to look at something usually pretty familiar in a new way, using new words, new imagery, to reimagine, to wonder. And if there's ever a season that calls out for poetry, it has to be Christmas. The Christmas story itself is pretty simple, prosaic even. You know, a peasant girl has a baby in Bethlehem. But behind that simple narrative, the concept that an eternal, transcendent, powerful God could enter into time and space, could become clothed in flesh, could become a tiny baby, vulnerable and small. And that's something that is just cloaked in mystery. It's something we can only begin to try and imagine, try and wrap our tiny brains around. Something we create analogies for and similes for, but not really something we can neatly define. Now, of course, that's not to say people haven't tried. Many of the early Christian theologians seem to have been kind of frustrated that the Bible doesn't clearly explain how the Trinity works and what exactly is meant by incarnation. So they set about thinking it all through, coming up with handy terms like hypostatic union to describe what it means for God to become human. They wrote a whole series of creeds and then proceeded to kill one another for not agreeing on the wording, which was an interesting approach. A fifth century theologian formulated what became known as the Athanasian Creed, and that aims to clearly and succinctly explain the Trinity, including what is meant by the incarnated Christ. We don't know who wrote it, except it definitely wasn't Athanasius because he had been dead for about 100 years by that time. It's just named after him. But it was written to be read as part of church worship services, although it's actually quite long. But in part, it reads thus, speaking of Christ. He is God from the essence of the Father, begotten before time, and he is human from the essence of his mother, born in time, completely God, completely human, with a rational soul and human flesh, equal to the Father as regards divinity, less than the Father as regards humanity. Although he is God and human, yet Christ is not two but one. He is one, however, not by his divinity being turned into flesh, but by God taking humanity to himself. He is one not by the blending of his essence, but by the unity of his person. But just as one human is both rational soul and flesh, so too the one Christ is both God and human. And so it goes on. I wonder, what would Jesus have thought if somebody came up to him and said, Jesus of Nazareth, I've got it. I think I know who you are. And then spouted all that. I can imagine Jesus kind of saying, well, I just tend to call myself the Son of Man, actually, but he probably wouldn't. He probably would have said something really profound. But dissecting and explaining how the Godhead works doesn't seem to have been something that Jesus was interested in. He liked stories. He liked parables that looked at familiar things in a new light, that asked people to slow down and reimagine. One of Jesus's favorite words seems to have been repent, think again. A word that we've kind of spoiled by associating it with shame and guilt, but actually a word that is full of opportunity and invitation. Think again, reimagine, wonder. And it's this sense of wonder that we see in scripture, rather than giving a detailed explanation of the incarnation. The writer of John's gospel turns to poetry in these familiar words. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. This is the language of poetry, not of scientific analysis. And the scriptures that are associated with the birth of Christ are filled with poetry. In Luke's gospel, Mary, Zechariah, the angels, and Simeon all sing songs. In Matthew's gospel, the author references five different ancient Jewish prophecies in the birth narrative. And Jewish prophecy is almost all written in poetic form. That doesn't mean it rhymes. Ancient Hebrew poetry didn't rhyme, but it has rhythm, it has word repetition, and most of all, it has parallelism, which is hard to say, where you have a couple of lines and the second line repeats the first line, but intensifies it or makes it more concrete. So, for example, when Matthew describes how Herod killed the infants in Bethlehem, he quotes the prophet Jeremiah. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. And I think it's understandable why prophecy would be written in poetic form. Poets and prophets often share a similar role. Next slide. They both speak of what is and what can be. They call out what is. They draw attention to it. They reinterpret it. They look at the meaning behind it. They also inspire or warn of what could be in the future. They look at present reality and then imagine that moving forward. We read a lot of passages from Isaiah during the season of Advent. By we, I don't mean just Cedar Ridge. I mean churches all over the world. And Isaiah was a master of both calling out what is in the present and also moving that into the future. Reading Isaiah has been described as like looking at a range of mountains and being unable to really judge the distances between the different peaks. Because Isaiah speaks to a nation of Israel, calling out their wickedness, warning them that they will be driven into exile in Babylon, comforting and encouraging them in exile, and speaking of God's future salvation, all very different points in time, different peaks, as it were. But the messages are overlapping. And God's salvation itself can be seen as kind of different peaks too. In some ways, the people were saved when they were allowed out of exile and returned to Israel. But they were still not a free and sovereign nation. There was a sense in which this salvation was yet to come. As followers of Jesus, we see salvation in the person of Jesus. That's why we read Isaiah so much at this time of year. But again, there are aspects that still seem to be in the future, yet to be fulfilled. The kingdom of God is at hand, as Jesus often said. It's within grasp, but we're still taught to pray, may your kingdom come. There is that future element. So let's look at one of Isaiah's poems. This one is often read at Christmas and is also often sung. It's part of Handel's Messiah, which you probably know is a wonderful oratorio that's often performed at this time of year. And in fact, actually, I find it hard to read this without kind of hearing Handel's music in my head. Here is the poem. Comfort ye, not in this translation, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling, in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. You who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good news to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up, do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and he rules with a mighty arm. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those who have young. The prophet here is writing to people in exile, far from their homeland, people living in a wilderness spiritually, emotionally, sociopolitically. And the prophet says to them, be comforted and get ready because God is coming to you. In this part of the poem, Isaiah doesn't talk about the people leaving exile and returning home, although he does that elsewhere. But here he says, get ready where you are in the wilderness, in this place of captivity and oppression, of insecurity, of disillusionment, of all those things. God is coming to you right there in the wilderness. And God's presence will be like a shepherd, gently tending a flock of sheep, gathering the lambs in his arms and holding them close to his heart. Such beautiful imagery of peace and security. Isaiah was addressing a nation in distress, and he gave voice to the current mood, the feeling that God was angry with Israel and was harshly punishing the nation. He also spoke words of comfort and encouragement, good news to chase away fear. God is coming to you with compassion, with tenderness. The idea of poets addressing the nation or giving voice to the nation is, of course, an extremely old one. There are examples of poetry commissioned by kings or other rulers, dating back to about the 25th century BCE. In the Greco-Roman world, there were official state poets, and that Greco-Roman practice of crowning a poet with a laurel wreath was reinstated in Italy in the early 14th century CE. And since then, many countries have created the post of a poet laureate, although obviously they don't tend to get the crowns anymore. But they are appointed by the government to compose poems for special occasions. Here in the US, the position of poet laureate wasn't created until relatively recently in 1937. And the US poet laureate is not so much appointed to write poems for special occasions as to promote poetry in general, particularly through a series of poetry readings and lectures at the Library of Congress. But poets do still address the nation on occasion. Six presidential inaugurations have had a poet read or recite one of their poems, the first being Robert Frost at JFK's 1961 inaugural. Interesting story. Not really relevant, but interesting. Frost had written a special poem for the inauguration, and then it was so sunny and the sun on the snow, he actually couldn't read it. And so he ended up just reciting one of his old ones. Totally not relevant, but I thought that was interesting. But in addition to inaugurations, poets have also been called on to read poems as part of the annual pageant of peace, better known as the Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Washington. That began in 1923, and it includes entertainers, a military band, and a presidential message of peace to the nation and the world, according to the website. Someone who has read one of her poems at both a presidential inauguration and a pageant of peace is Dr. Maya Angelou. And the pageant of peace in December 2005, Angelou read Amazing Peace. And so let's listen to her read that poem now.
When I was invited to attend the Christmas tree lighting at the White House and to deliver a poem on the occasion, I was honored. Tsunami, a major earthquake, Katrina and Rita had already happened to our world. I thought of the evacuees and realized that in times of hostilities and natural disasters, each human being becomes an evacuee. I thought that what we need now most, more than food and water, is peace. I wrote this poem, Amazing Peace. Thunder rumbles in the mountain passes, and lightning rattles the eaves of our houses. Flood waters await in our avenues. Snow falls upon snow falls upon snow to avalanche over unprotected villages. The ground shakes and swallows entire hamlets. The sky slips low and gray and threatening. We question ourselves, What have we done to so affront nature? We interrogate and worry God. Are you there? Are you there really? Does the covenant you made with us still hold? Into this climate of fear and apprehension, Christmas enters, streaming lights of joy, ringing bells of hope, and singing carols of forgiveness high up in the bright air. The world is encouraged to come away from rancor, come the way of friendship. It is the glad season. Thunder ebbs to silence, and lightning sleeps quietly in the corner. Flood waters recede into memory. Snow becomes a yielding cushion to aid us as we make our way to higher ground. Hope is born again in the faces of children. It rides on the shoulders of our aged as they walk into their sunsets. Hope spreads around the earth, brightening all things, even hate, which crouches breeding in dark corridors. In our joy, we think we hear a whisper. At first, it is too soft, then only half heard. We listen carefully as it gathers strength. We hear a sweetness. The word is peace. It is loud now, louder than the explosion of bombs. We tremble at the sound. We are thrilled by its presence. It is what we have hungered for, not just the absence of war, but true peace, a harmony of spirit, a comfort of courtesies, security for our beloveds and their beloveds. We clap hands and welcome the peace of Christmas. We beckon this good season to wait a while with us. We Baptist and Buddhist, Methodist and Muslim, say, come peace, come and fill us and our world with your majesty. We, the Jew and the Jainist, the Catholic and the Confucian, implore you, stay a while with us, so we may learn by your shimmering light how to look beyond complexion and see community. It is Christmas time, a halting of hate time. On this platform of peace, we can create a language to translate ourselves to ourselves and to each other. At this holy instant, we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ into the great religions of the world. We jubilate the precious advent of trust. We shout with glorious tongues at the coming of hope. All the earth's tribes loosen their voices to celebrate the promise of peace. We, angels and mortals, believers and non-believers, look heavenward and speak the word aloud, peace. We look at our world and speak the word aloud, peace. We look at each other, then into ourselves, and we say without shyness or apology or hesitation, peace, my brother, peace, my sister, peace, my soul.
This is quite a well-known poem. It's even been simplified and turned into a children's book, but it addresses some dark issues. As mentioned in the introduction, Hurricane Katrina had devastated the Gulf Coast just months previously, leading to over 1,800 deaths and the destruction or serious damaging of 850,000 homes. Less than a year before the poem was read, an earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean had killed an estimated 230,000 people. And we hear hints of the devastating impacts of these events and of global climate change in general in the first verse of this poem. Angelou writes, "The flood waters await us in our avenues." And she asks God, "Does the covenant you made with us still hold?" The covenant with Noah, illustrated by a rainbow, was, of course, never to flood the whole world. The poem asks the very real question that most of us, if not all of us, ask when faced with scenes of devastation and loss. God, are you there? Are you there really? But into this damaged world, into a society fractured by racial and religious divisions, comes Christmas, bringing joy, hope, and forgiveness. Maya Angelou speaks as a poet and prophetically as a woman of faith and sees the birth of Christ as inclusive. It's for all people. It's a birth that reveals our shared humanity across barriers of race and religion. It's the presence of God that brings peace that becomes louder than the explosion of bombs. And that is so much more than just an end to war. It's a peace that heals the planet, that puts lightning to sleep, and makes floodwaters recede, that turns snowdrifts into pillows to support us as we make our way to higher ground. In this poem, Dr. Angelou undertakes the holy work of poets and prophets, of reimagining what life could be like, of painting pictures of hope and peace, even in the midst of hardship and turmoil. But isn't this all rather idealistic? Can peace really be found in the midst of something as devastating as the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina? Well, to answer that, I'd like to invite up Kathleen Koch, a former CNN correspondent who was sent to her home state of Mississippi to cover that story, and later authored a best-selling book and produced two prize-winning documentaries on the recovery efforts of her hometown. Kathleen is also, of course, a longtime Cedar Ridge member. So let's give her a warm welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Ruth.
Thank you for joining us. So Kathleen, can you give us some idea of, you know, how did this all happen? How did you find yourself in the midst of all that devastation? And what were some of your initial impressions? I mean, we all saw the news, we saw the photos, but I'm sure it was very different in person. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, at the time I was working as a correspondent for CNN, and I was actually clamoring to go down there and cover the hurricane coming in. That may seem crazy, but I'd grown up on the Mississippi Gulf Coast in a tiny little town about an hour east of New Orleans called Bay St. Louis, so I wanted to be there. And so I think we have some slides. That was what things looked like the next morning. And that's a street in my hometown of Bay St. Louis. A lot of people know the story of New Orleans, but not Mississippi. And in Mississippi, 238 people died. Over 100,000 were left homeless within a matter of hours. And at times like that, I mean, people felt so helpless. Right. You know, they had no food, no water, no possessions, no shelter. And it's very easy for helplessness to slip into hopelessness. What encouraged me as I was there was that I saw people making that choice that they have to make anywhere in the world after a major disaster or a crisis. And that was whether to be a passive victim or an active survivor. And I saw so many people choosing to act, choosing to find just small ways to bring order, some form of order into chaos. Of course, people couldn't rebuild their homes, but we saw flags, American flags, draped on whatever was left standing. It wasn't much. And people pulled them up out on the rubble because it just wasn't right to leave them there. Mississippi is a hospitality state. So as we were doing our coverage and we drove over some railroad tracks into the most devastated part of Long Beach, Mississippi, there was a woman sitting in her driveway in a chair, a folding chair, and she waved us down. And there was no plumbing, nothing was working, no electricity, but her house was on a well. So she offered, hey, would you like some water? Do you want to come in and use the bathroom? Yeah. Again, just bringing peace to this disorder and chaos. One of the most poignant things I saw was in Gulfport, near this huge casino barge. It's like the length of three football fields, four stories high. It had been lifted up by the 30-foot storm surge and deposited on shore. And nearby there, on the ground, on near the water, where there'd been a marine life oceanarium, was a huge sea lion. They'd had to leave 19 of them behind. They couldn't move them at the last minute. They left dolphins and lots of animals. And so here was this 600-pound creature lying there baking the sun after the hurricane. People couldn't do much. There was no way to move it. So they formed a human bucket brigade, and they were bringing buckets of water from the Gulf and dumping water on it, just trying to do something. These acts, these small acts, they had agency, and that brought them peace.
What do you think it is that allows some people to find peace in these kind of situations when others can't? You know, are you able to think what that was? I don't know if you were there during the holidays, but I would think that that is a particular
yes.
time when it becomes difficult, right?
It's a very hard time. One of my friends said the previous 4 months, they'd really been going on adrenaline. Mm-hmm. She said, but then the holidays hit, and that's when you realize your holiday traditions are gone. Your ornament collection, your grandmother's Christmas china, the Christmas tree skirt, your daughter's sewed in Girl Scouts. But what people in so many communities there did was they clung to their faith. I think we had a church on every corner in Bay St. Louis, and they clung to their sense of community. And then there was this shared determination to keep moving things forward, because virtually everyone was impacted. I mean, 95% of Bay St. Louis was underwater, so it wasn't like anyone was left untouched. So they pulled together, and even the youngest, we have a shot of one of the schools in Bay St. Louis, what was left of it. And one of my friends was a teacher at this school. Now, at that point, they were going to school in December in trailers. It had been tents, and then they moved to trailers. She gave an assignment to the students to write on 3x5 cards what they wanted for Christmas. And, you know, normally it would be bikes and balls and games and toys. And these are third graders, right? Dolls. And the most popular item on their list of what they wanted for Christmas was sheetrock and other building supplies, because even the youngest felt that need to be part of the solution, be an active survivor. And what also comforted so many in our community during the holidays was the knowledge that they weren't alone. And what gave them that knowledge was volunteers who came pouring in from all around the country, and some came from Cedar Ridge. I was so proud of it was a men's group that went down there and helped in Bay St. Louis. And it just gave the people in Mississippi that sense that they weren't alone, because they did feel very forgotten. I think if you ask most people in the U.S., they'd say, oh yeah, Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans.
Right.
They didn't understand what happened in Mississippi. So that comfort, no, it's hard enough to suffer and lose everything, but when no one even realizes what happened to you, it's even harder.
Right. And you've given a few examples already, but are there any other examples? I think probably all of us, you know, the scale of the destruction was just so huge. It's easy to feel like, well, one little person, you know, I can't really make a difference. But can you give us a few examples of where just an ordinary person really did make a difference?
Absolutely. After Katrina, the recovery, both in Louisiana and Mississippi, and even Alabama was impacted, the recovery moved so slowly, and it was very, very frustrating for people. And in particular, I think it was really hard, especially at the holidays, for people to see the children suffering. They all had to grow up so fast, right? And all they had to play in, as the adults were trying to rebuild the community, was debris piles or empty lots like this after the debris piles were cleared. And one of my friends from middle school, Ginny Vegas Reynolds, this really made her mad, because she had gone through this herself 36 years ago, when that was the last time Bay St. Louis was hit by a major hurricane, and that was Hurricane Camille. And she remembered that. She remembered feeling like she was a child with nowhere left to be a child anymore. And she said, you know, this will not stand. And she called that out. And she said, I'm not going to let the kids today suffer the way we did. So she reached out to a nonprofit that's based right nearby here in Washington, D.C., and it's called Kaboom. And Kaboom normally built playgrounds in poor, underprivileged neighborhoods. And she brought them down there, and they agreed to help build a playground in Bay St. Louis. And so 1 week before Christmas in 2005, hundreds and hundreds of volunteers joined Ginny and the people of Kaboom, and they built a beautiful playground in Bay St. Louis. Now you might say, well, that's great. So that helped hundreds of kids in Bay St. Louis. That's not a lot. Well, the people of Kaboom were inspired by Ginny's vision, and they said, oh my gosh, I mean, this was a huge hurricane. It hit areas from Mobile, Alabama, past New Orleans. All of those communities could probably use a playground. Let's start Operation Playground. So they decided they would build 100 playgrounds took them 2.5 years, but they did it. And the last of the 100 they built in another neighborhood of Bay St. Louis. And so that little spark by one person lit a flame. I mean, after the hurricane, people felt like ants trying to move a mountain. Well, one ant by him or herself can't move a mountain, but together tens of thousands can. It just takes one to get it started. And any of us can be that one.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much, Kathleen. Great. Let's give it a round of applause. Thank you. Jesus calls us all to be poets and prophets, to rethink, to repent, to imagine another way. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells us to look at the birds, the ordinary birds, the birds we see every day, and see them in a new light, see them as evidence of God's kindness and care. To look at the wildflowers and see God's creativity and abundant provision. Jesus tells us to rethink how we respond to people, to react in a new, reimagined way, a compassionate way, a way of love, to love our enemies and pray for those who hurt us, to give generously to those who ask, to go the extra mile, overcome evil with good, even at the risk of being taken advantage of. Jesus tells us to choose peace instead of anxiety. As Kathleen was saying, we have that choice to not worry about tomorrow, but to trust God even in the hard times. The Message version translates it like this. Give your entire attention to what God is doing right now, and don't get worked up about what may or may not happen tomorrow. God will help you deal with whatever hard things come up when the time comes. At the heart of peace is knowing that God is with us. In the wilderness of exile, in the aftermath of Katrina, God is present. In the midst of poverty and Roman occupation, God was visibly present, not as a mighty hero to put everything right and you know, make everything better, but as a baby caught up in it all, just as we are, vulnerable and exposed, just as we are. God present, recklessly present for the sake of love. The incarnation calls us to see God in a new way, not as one who magics away all the troubles of life, but as one who joins us. God is with us in all we have to deal with today and will be with us in all the challenges of tomorrow. The incarnation also calls us to see the world in a different way, as a place where God is, where God can be found in the unlikeliest of places, a place where we can reimagine how we treat one another and how we treat our planet, a place where love can and will win the day. As one poet put it, in God's presence is the essence of perfect earth. In one birth knows all earth the essence of God's presence. As we come to communion now, we're gonna welcome God's presence. The band want to come up as well. We're gonna welcome the hope of reimagining life, rethinking of life through the lens of love. We're going to welcome the recklessness of God's love shown in an infant in a manger. We're going to welcome the joy of Christmas. I'm going to welcome the peace that comes in knowing that God is here with us in all the joys and all the heartbreaks of life. In just a moment, I'm going to invite you to come and take communion. You can take it at the tables here at the front or the table in the middle. You might want to take it together at the table or take it back to your seat, whichever you feel most comfortable with. And we're going to take communion as a tangible sign of God's presence with us, as God's oneness with us as we eat and drink. Everyone is welcome to take communion. There are other ways to respond too. You can light a candle at the back as a prayer. You can make a financial offering. You can write out a prayer and put it in the stations under Journey and Grow. We'll pray for you during the week. You might just want to sit and listen to the music or join along. But before we do all that, I want to invite you to slow down and make space for peace in this busy, stressful, emotional season. Maybe we can put the lights down a bit and invite you to close your eyes or look at the candles, whichever you prefer. We're all coming from different places emotionally and in terms of our circumstances, and we all have different needs for peace. We might need to let go of anxiety and invite God's peace into all the things that we know we can't control. We might need to reimagine aspects of our life that we know we're not seeing, we're not living out through a lens of love. We might need to rekindle hope. Whatever it is, I invite you to quieten your mind and welcome the presence of God into the space. God of reckless love, we welcome your presence with us. We welcome your hope, your joy, your love, your peace. We welcome you.